after going through the whole long list, I would be like if I remembered my own name. I leave that to you to introduce your team, sir. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and we also appreciate the opportunity that we've been provided to can address the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. I will first start by introducing my team, and I'll let them introduce themselves and what they do at ITEC before we continue. And I can introduce myself. I'm Dumela Maseke.
Good morning. I'm William Kilo Mahasani. I'm the Communication Specialist for ITEC.
Good morning. I'm Karina Krugier. I'm Head of Trade Remedies 1.
Hello, I'm Nikki Clear, Head of Legal Services.
I'm Siyabulela Sengi, the General Manager for the core business.
Good morning, I'm Alexander Emma, and I'm Senior Manager for Policy and Research.
Good morning, today I'm Philip Maimon, Director of Import Export Control.
Good morning, my name is Brenda Mavasso. I'm the Senior Manager for Tariff Investigations 2.
Good morning, my name is Roleka Kalindini. I'm the Senior Manager at Trade Remedies 2.
Morning to all. My name is Juju Mufugeng, Senior Manager at Tariff Investigations 1. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. As you can see, we have brought the experts to actually deal with the operations, and I think they're in a better position to answer some of the detailed questions that the members might have. Mine would just be to introduce the overall perspective of the institution and then give it over to the relevant senior managers to take the committee through the different aspects of the commission. It's important, and this is what I indicated at the last meeting we had with the Portfolio Committee when we were presenting our annual report, to explain the relationship between ITEC, who we are, and the relationship we have with our main shareholder, which is the Department of Trade and Industry. ITEC is an institution that was established by an Act of Parliament by the Department of Trade and Industry. We are responsible for administering trade, as it relates to tariff amendments, trade remedies, and import and export control. I will not go into the details. I've got the people who will take you through the details in the presentations. The relationship with the DTI, and I am always at pains to explain this to anyone who listens. ITEC administers. We are responsible for the administration. The DTI, which is our shareholder, makes the policy, the policy environment within which we function. Usually you get questions that relate to policy. I don't need to say you cannot answer. People think that we are being crude. However, it is very true that we administer the environment that has been given to us by the DTI. Of course, we do give input when requested, technical input. When the DTI is, for instance, looking at making one policy or another, we will give technical input in terms of that. So I think if we get that particular framework in mind, when we ask more about the technical questions related to trade administration. Furthermore, that there is also a difference between the work that ITEC does and SARS. I think when we go through the presentations, you will see it has happened in several recent years. We've actually had a meeting with someone referred by a parliamentary member, but the questions were for SARS. And also this kind of meeting, when I explained that there is nothing that ITEC can do, it's like you don't want to have government like this, you don't want to have. But we all have different mandates, and ours is very circumscribed. The objectives and aims of this workshop, it emanates from a request that we received from the Portfolio Committee, I think in 2005, when we came to make our presentation, that we need to engage with the Honourable Members on the work that we do, so they also understand what we do and house, because there are instances where we will need the parliamentarians' assistance and how they can be in a position to get assistance. So this idea is more to share on what we do, what is the role of IPEC, how we can, going forward, continuously engage. So you don't only come here once a year to come and report to you or another report. Come and table our another report, and then we come again 12 months later. So there is continuous engagement between the two parties. Our mandate, this organization is in such a way that I'm not going to, we are not going to bore the members with our ITA Act. I think you are familiar with the Act. So we'll just take you through how we do what is stipulated in the Act in terms of the functions of ITAC. Our mandate basically is to foster economic growth and development and promote employment and investment. And how do we do that? Through the different instruments that we have. Trade remedies. The head of trade remedies section one will take you through one will take you through that. And please let us listen to this one. It's anti-dumping, countervailing and safeguards. It is unfortunate that as you will explain that in our country most use is of anti-dumping. And people think that is the only instrument that they can use. There are other two instruments and they all have criteria that need to be fulfilled. So I think it would be good if you take when it takes you through that. And also what is dumping? Because even our media doesn't understand dumping. What they write there in some of the articles as dumping is not necessarily dumping.
Just a second. Good. Nonkonyan, my chief, please, the cell phone, I don't appreciate it in my meeting, chief. If you can do that business outside, with due respect to the presenters and everyone else. Thanks.
Thank you, chief. But you need, like I said, our mandate is circumscribed to the Act. We have to administer international trade only as it relates to trade remedies, tariff investigations, tariff amendments, and import and export control. Some of the work that we do, especially in import and export control, is for other departments. We administer permits for other departments. The head of import and export control will take you through that. How we do, what are the requirements, how is the alignment to the DTI policies and broader government policies in promoting investment and manufacturing. Our work is also within the constraints of government policies and the policy environment. Recently, I tried to align its work with the National Industrial Policy Framework and see how we can assist government in, for instance, the aim of promoting manufacturing and assisting downstream industries. So in the work that we do take into consideration the broader government objectives and those policies and how, in administering the tools that we have, we can assist government in doing that. Secondly, it is important to understand that within our policy framework also, we also administer international agreements. That is where we have been a number of problems. Because people come and say that, they don't say ITEC, they say government is not helping us. Although they are referring to ITEC, however, we explain to them that you also have international obligations. You cannot do what you like just because you want to protect your industries. Government has acceded to a number of agreements and needs to adhere to those. So you function within the WTO arena as well. The last aspect of our work also relates to SACU. I think you are aware that in the object of our act also it refers to working within the common customs area. What ITEC is doing currently is it has been designated as a tariff board. By the Council of Ministers. Secondly, we offer capacity building to the member states. We have currently, I think, 11 people from the BNS countries who are going through on-the-job training. I think the program is coming to an end very soon. They'll take you through the whole process. However, what we do is not like training of getting people into a room and then giving them to us training. They are with us for a period of 12 to 18 months and going through on-the-job training. We give continuous reports to the Council of Ministers. At the end of the program, we will give a comprehensive report for the ministers and they can make a decision on to whether we can then have a second intake of people from the SACU state. Further to that, we do also give technical assistance to the DTI itself in engagement with SACU. For instance, now that there's been engagement on the annexes, we have participated with that. There's been engagement in how to get the SACU structures functioning. So I take from a technical aspect, I want to emphasize this, because at some point, it ends up as if it is ITEC's role. It is not. I'm saying that because at what happens to this institution, we then get the resources that we have are so stretched that we also can't function to can meet our basic mandate, which becomes difficult as our mandate change, increase, as I'll speak very soon. Before I go on to the ATEC structure, SACU mandate was given to us, I think, 2 years ago as a new mandate. Of course, it was a funded mandate. We then had another aspect added to our mandate, the import restrictions for Chinese clothing. I want to also explain that although you will be taken through the process, however, the DTI, through the Minister of Finance and the Presidency, negotiated an agreement with the Chinese counterparts. ITEC was asked to administer one aspect of that. The last leg is administered by FAS. And I think it is important that people understand that we were not responsible for the quotas, the broad quotas that they published. We administer what the minister said, this is what we've agreed with the Chinese. Then help us, we can administer that. That's where we come in at ITEC. And you are doing that, we'll take you through the process for the presentation. I think it's very important that people understand that. As the senior ministers have introduced themselves, I did it for two sections, two main sections in ITEC. One, core business, that is the main content of our work. One, corporate services. The core business is made up of trade remedies. Because of the amount of work in trade remedies, we've got trade remedies one and trade remedies two. Ideally, do the same work within the same environment. You've got tariff investigations one, tariff investigations two. They do the same work, however, they look at particular sectors. They will take you through the different sectors that they do. Just split on sectors that they look at, but it's more of the same work. And then you've got import and export control. And then we have policy and research. This is sort of like a new area of ours to make sure that we also have what is called institutional memory. To make sure that when people leave, they do not leave with the knowledge of the work, but you can continue the institution. And then we have our legal services, which is very busy. Unfortunately, in the work that ITEC does, there are always unsatisfied parties. Every time there will be two parties. One for and one against. Whatever decision you make, there's going to be somebody who's unhappy. And we have a number of cases in court. Some criminal and some civil. So we are in court a lot. We also have one pending case in the Constitutional Court by a company that's not happy with our decision. So we're also very, very, very busy in the legal sector. Then we've got a secretariat that manages the commission and the work that it does. Our objectives are linked to the DTI objectives. We try as much as possible. Although we are established as an independent institution by the DTI, however, we try to make sure that we meet the goals and objectives of the DTI within our mandate. And our objectives are more linked to the objectives of the DTI. And important about our objectives, the second one, that is to ensure that we reduce production costs. There is a trend that we've begun to see recently that I'll talk about China broadly, not about importance, not about Chinese clothing. For instance, when we initiate a case, a dumping case against China, and we go and verify, but we find out that there is no dumping, and I think the general manager has stated this, we also meet the DG, the meeting we had, that there is something that government must do to look at how do we engage with China specifically and have like a strategy on engaging with China. The cost structure is different. You find out that there is, internationally there is no dumping because in terms of the instruments that you do. And companies say that we are suffering. And it's all of those things. I think broadly there needs to be some engagement at a policy level of saying how do we as government start engaging and then having a particular strategy of engaging. So we can't just look at it as a thing that the Chinese are taking our jobs. I know it's a big problem. They are killing our industries. They are. It is a fact, but what is it that they are doing that we are not doing? How are their cost structures? How are their fixes efficient? How are the efficiencies? So I think it's all of those broad things that we need to look at. Although in terms of our objectives, like I guess second one, we do try, you know, whatever decisions we make to ensure that we reduce production costs. The other aspect of I won't go through all the strategic objectives, so let's just go through the important ones. Because government has taken a policy objective to ensure that we promote export, have an export-oriented strategy. We also look at that in applications that come to ATEC. So we look at how our people are doing in order to promote export. So whatever decisions that the commission makes, and the commission is made up of about 8 members currently. We've got 7 part-time members. I'm the deputy chief commissioner, acting at the moment as the chief commissioner. So when we make a decision, we look at all these objectives. We look at the policies that we have been taking through, the different policies that we have to ensure that whatever decisions we make are aligned to government policies. With that, Chairperson, I don't know if there are questions, but I was just giving a broad outline and ensure that we didn't go through the details. The senior managers are able to speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that very broad but informative introduction. I must just say that from my side, unfortunately today, I've got 6 apologies from members. And I was very keen that people go through this. But that's a different matter. There's nothing I can do about that. We'll continue with the people that are here. We are in your ablest.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will now have the presentation from Trade Remedies. It will represent the 2 sections because they do the same work. However, I forgot one important aspect on the program. After 11:13, I would like to have the 2 presentations switched. The one from current investigations and import and export control. We'll start with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. At Interstate, there are 2 units dealing with trade remedies. So, the trade remedies one that I'll present and. Okay, let's have this one a little bit better. Trade Remedies 1 that I represent and Trade Remedies 2 that is represented by the LECA. The units basically do the same work as just the revisions based on volume. Now the main functions of Trade Remedies are dealing with the 3 instruments that we have, being anti-dumping, countervailing and safeguards. And as Ito has alluded to, the one that is used mainly at ITAC is the anti-dumping instrument. We have done some countervailing investigations in the past, but usually the margin of subsidy is also covered by the dumping duty, so it seems like industry prefers to use the dumping instrument. With regard to the safeguard, I'll explain a bit more about it later, but it's basically used in very exceptional circumstances, and I think that's why South Africa has opted not to use it yet. There was an application by the clothing industry for a safeguard measure, and we opted to go the negotiation route through the DGI and then the process that we imposed. With regard to the purpose of trade remedies, as Isamelina said, there are different strategic objectives of ITAC that are in line with the DGI, and where we link up is with the competitiveness objective, both international competitiveness and domestic competitiveness. I think it's important to know with a trade remedy that it's not about the fair trade that the tariff investigation people will talk about, that it's mainly about the unfair trade practices. And that ITAS will only assist with a trade remedy when there is an unfair trade practice that causes injury to the global industry. With regard to the strategic role, I think it's important to note that anti-dumping is used widely in all countries around the world, but the dumping practice is not something that is uncommon in trade. It's a very used practice by most manufacturers that export in an attempt to get share of a foreign market. So it's not an uncommon practice. And therefore, we'll see from the agreement in the WTO that it's also not a prohibited practice. So in itself, dumping is not wrong. It's where you talk about injury to the market that you can start acting. So it's not dumping per se, but more injurious dumping. And the purpose of having these anti-dumping duties is just to level the playing field to a fair trade situation. So ITAC is not giving this on request. It's only in very specific circumstances where you can prove that the injury is caused by the dumping that is taking place. And in line with this strategic objective and more strict use of this instrument, we are also in the process now of amending some of the legislation that we use. Just to mention two, we used to have a situation where people would come and make oral presentations to the Commission. It's a very one-sided situation because you always have one party giving its view. And we decided to attempt to replace this by a public hearing where any party could be present. And it will also enhance the transparency of the whole process. The other very important aspect that we are adding is the public interest clause. It's already added in the draft legislation, to give an opportunity for the minister to ask ITAC to do a public interest investigation. In some instances, for instance, with medicine and so on, it might not be in the public interest to actually have this duty. Also in instances where it would damage the downstream industries and so on. So that is also a provision that we are adding to our legislation. Just in short, the legislative framework that we use is mainly the Act. Some things are written very clearly in the Act. But then in specifics, we use the WTO agreement. There are three agreements that are subject to our work. The one is the anti-dumping agreement. The other is the subsidies and countervailing measures agreement. And then also the safeguards agreement. And in line with that, we've also issued regulations for each of the three different fields, just in an attempt to give more clarity to people applying and to be more transparent. I'm going to go a bit into the technical stuff, although I'll just touch on it broadly. Just to say what dumping is, and I think sometimes it's easier to say what dumping is not to explain what it actually is. A lot of people think that, there are people that really think if something is coming in cheap into the country, it's dumped. And that's not, in 90% of the cases, it's not true. So what is dumping? It's when a product is exported from another country at a price lower than what is selling in that country. There are different ways of determining this. Some are easier than others. And at the moment, we also have a special dispensation based on an agreement that we have with China of how we determine this dumping margin. Just very short, what is countervailing? It's basically when there's a subsidy that is given by a foreign government, and that is an influence on the price that the product is exported at. And obviously, it has to cause injury before you can act. Safeguard action, as I've said before, is only used in very special circumstances. It's a short-term measure that is used, and it's basically against a surge of imports and to allow the industry to adjust to the situation. In the allegation of dumping or suffering, as I've mentioned, there are three legs. You always have to prove all three legs before you can impose a measure. One being the dumping or the suffering, then the threat of injury or actual injury, and then the link between the two. And if a commission finds in accordance with the agreement, if you find that there's no dumping, the investigation stops. Or if you find there's no injury, the investigation stops. So there needs to be all three of these legs before you can actually impose a measure. It's a bit different in the safeguard investigations. You prove a surge of imports. There's a lot of discussion, not only in South Africa, but internationally, about what exactly a surge is. So it's in most instances, a very good guess. A lot of cases are taken to the WTO, not South African cases, but internationally, about what exactly a surge is. So there's a long, big discussion about that. And then, other than anti-dumping and countervailing, where we prove material injury, here we prove serious injury. Now, also on this, there's a lot of discussion. Nobody's been able to define what material injury is. So, when you ask what serious injury is, it's more than material, but nobody knows exactly what material is. So, it's a judgment call that each authority has to make. In the material injury or serious injury analysis, there are 14 different economic factors that we look at. This information is provided by the shelter industry concerned. And I think it's important to note that you don't have to find positive on all 14 to be able to impose a duty. Some instances, you find that there's only price injury, prices are going down or being suppressed. And in some instances, prices are going up, but the volumes are going down. Sales are down, and market share is down. So it depends on a case-to-case basis, and the Commission considers all these factors and then makes a decision whether there's injury or not. With regard to the process and the time frames, I'm not going to take you through the whole process. I think it's sufficient to say that there are different phases. The complaints phase, merit, prelim, and final decision. And that we have reports or essential fact letters that go out after each of these phases to give people an opportunity to comment and to give their input. It's a long process. It takes between 12 and 18 months to get final measures. And I think a lot of people will always say that, you know, South Africa takes very long and everywhere else in the world it's a quick process. Fortunately or unfortunately, it's a process that is exactly the same for each country that belongs to the WTO and that follows the rules of the WTO. So I think South Africa is actually doing quite well in terms of time. Provisional measures are usually imposed within 6 months after the issue. And then just to give some statistics on what we've done the last 3 years, some of the statistics might look like they don't make sense because of the time frame, 12 to 18 months, some of them are carried over from 1 year to the other. But I think in general, the trend is that we have less applications, we have less duties that we impose. And I think that is as a result of the stricter initiation requirements that we have. We receive a lot of applications, but a lot of them don't result in initiating an investigation. And I think also the Commission has decided that we need to be a lot more stricter in applying the duties because of the effect that the duty actually has. And then lastly, just to mention the type of industries that are involved, you'll see it covers a very wide range. And actually, in all of them, you are looking at investigations for both the primary and the downstream industry. And then we also have, apart from these major ones, a very small number of investigations pertaining to agricultural products. We have started to do a bit more canvassing with the agricultural people, just explaining the instrument, because I think the industry is fine. They know the instruments, they know what they can do. But it seems that there's a lot of misinformation in the agricultural sector. And I think actually the instrument can do a lot of good in the administration of the agricultural sector.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, ma'am. I think that at this stage it would be propitious to avail the opportunity to members to make comments and then ask questions. And then we go with the other inputs from other units. First of the block is Professor Cheng, followed by Comrade Danny Wilfat and Mr. Labaskar at the mic. Prof.
Thank you, and also thank for the IPC's to give us explanations. You know, you see, there's the first gentleman, you know, talking about this is in our country, they don't have a lot of dumpings, you know. I think that is before we said that. I think we sure, IPC sure has to look how to educate our industry here to prepare ourselves to give the evidence for the dumping. You know, to my personal experience, that is the U.S., even before they left the quota, all the industries, they prepare themselves fully so that, you know, when the first year, even 6 months, all the industries, they can fly in immediately to prove that is, you know, the China is overshipping. And I also know, after 2 years, that 2007, all the Americans, the manufacturer, they are really prepare all the documents, you know, to collect all the information is to try to prove the anti-dumping after the doors are open again. So what I'm saying is that, you know, I think dumping is there. The problem is the industry is in our country doesn't have such kind of knowledge to prepare themselves to say how they could prove the dumping is there. I think that is even when they say the China and the textile clothing industries was threatened to our countries, you know, the industries. Even you ask our industries here to give them some of the proof, I don't believe that they can give you the sufficient one. So what I'm suggesting here, maybe I can look on educate our industries here, at least to know how they're going to collect all this information and knowledge, you know, and, you know, to prepare ourselves, you know, to against, you know, the foreign countries, the dumping or, you know, the overshipping. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Chen. Comrade Danny.
Chairperson, thank you. I'm not so sure. I'm a layperson in this regard. Professor Chang has probably got more knowledge. But I must say the effect of what we perceive as dumping in South Africa has had a huge effect on particularly the textile industry. Now, if people come and tell us, we may think it's dumping, but it's not really dumping. Now, the effect out there and the effects of it says something different. And secondly, when the industry started to complain about the dumping process, the department took a very arrogant attitude by saying that that industry must get their houses in order. Now, South Africa did not face those kind of, or the industry did not face the process of dumping before because, you know, the South African industry was fairly protected. And suddenly, you know, the doors were thrown open, and the poor industries were on their own. And they were particularly arrogant. Now, I would agree to say that, look, companies must organize themselves. But I would also like to propose that the department in itself must start speaking to various industries. You know, even with the computer age, to speak to the department, particularly in the industry, hell, man, it's like going to open it. You just don't get a reply that is satisfactory. Now, if poor business X, you know, and one of the reasons why some of the small business falls before they even started is that it's not that relative easy communication between the department, the various departments or sections in the industry and business out there. So one would really appeal that these issues that we have been exposed to, that it also be exposed to Muslim business out there, because that would assist a lot in developing our economy. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, will you find Mr. Lapska?
Probably, sorry, slightly covered by Mr. Willifont. You see, the thing that worries me is we have industries employing lots of people. It's like steel, glass, paper, textiles. Now you suddenly face, you are having to deal with South African business conditions. I mean, now telecoms are expensive, you know, fuel expensive, and so forth. And then you come take a country like China, you know, where everything is very inexpensive. So you can't say it's technically dumping, but it is killing us and putting our people out of work. You know, it's all very well just to say, well, we'll import X. And you say to South Africa to become more competitive. But they are faced to things such as, you know, taxes and all these constraints which you don't find in a country like China. Now, I know where do we balance this? Where do we balance this? I mean, I have a case of a factory in the East Rand that used to manufacture. They employed 20-odd people, that's 20 families, manufacturing an item, small item, which they sold the municipality, traffic lights or something. Suddenly somebody comes, right guy, gets two partners, two ladies from BEE ladies, and they import these things from China, cheaper. Now, fine, the municipality can argue, well, we're saving X, but 18 families are now destitute. No jobs. I honestly, you know, we are a developing country, and then you're facing this, is it fair, is it unfair? Because conditions in China, wages in China, you know, trade unions, take China as an example, there are other countries in that, depending on the product. You know, state subsidies, etc., etc., etc. That are indirect subsidies. You're not subsidizing the product, such as the agricultural, the EU people are. But, you know, the factory is provided for free, you're working slave labor, slave rates, and this type of thing. Now, where do we stand on that? Thank you.
Thank you. Comrade Mike.
Thank you, Comrade. I should think the previous speakers overall covered what I was going to ask. But just to emphasize one point, I should think our maybe definition of dumping goes along with the WTO. And the explanation was that dumping in itself is not illegal. And that would mean, as according to the WTO. But the question remains, that is what my colleague have just said. The main objective of ITEC, or one of the objectives, is economic growth. Even if it's not qualified, but economic growth without employment, it's not good for us. So if the definition of WTO is making us lose jobs, I think it's not good for us. The way in that one my colleague was saying, is that if we're just following what everybody is doing, not objectively, but just to be one of those people in the world at the expense of our own people. And I had another question on the industries that I think is involved in. Agriculture is not in there. I don't know whether the reason is because people in agriculture are not aware of ITEC's objectives or so. And I'm thinking about the tea industry. I think now that some tea industries have closed down in South Africa and we are importing from Kenya and Malawi. I'm not sure whether there's dumping involved there or whether something can't be done with the definition of dumping for the good of our workers here. I mean, we can't blame COSATU and say they must start reducing salaries of their workers. That would be an impossible demand from whoever. And one other question, I think I missed the explanation of the public interest, or what actually it is said that it's going to be added to the new legislation. What is it about? I understand the public hearings and so on, but I missed the public interest. So what actually does that involve? Thank you, Congress Chair.
Thank you, members. Just one or two remarks before I give the presenters to answer. The issues that we are dealing with are very complex, one. But they are also pertinent to the economy of the country, second point. But we also, in our engagement, need to remember the introduction that Mr. Ntumeleng made this morning. The function and role of ITEC is to carry out government policy as enunciated by the DTI, Department of Trade and Industry. The issues that they are dealing with are also complex if we use our institutional memory. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we had public hearings here in Parliament. Public hearings in regard to what? The role plays in the textile industry. They came to make presentations in Parliament. After that engagement, we also had input by the Department of Trade and Industry. I don't want to go throughout the content of those public hearings. To summarize, but one or two aspects. There were the challenges faced by the textile clothing industry, for example. There were other industries that also came to the fore. What government also pointed out then, the department, to the main players from the clothing and textile industry, there were assistance programs provided by government in order to assist our industries to cope with the development out internationally. Grants, monies were given. And in a number of instances, unfortunately, the same grants that were given in order to buttress the technology infrastructure in order to compete internationally, they used this money to buy Chinese goods. Come a few years later, in order to address this problem of the influx of Chinese goods, at that, I'm speaking about 4 years ago, the current issue was that government must put a stop to the influx of Chinese goods. Negotiations with the Chinese, indeed, government says that we are going to limit the importation of Chinese goods. Last year, towards the end of the year, you remember what made headlines, that this program of government seeking to limit the influx of Chinese goods, it's going to harm our profit margins. Quite a number of the same place. So in that context, I asked myself, and I said to some of these role players, in order to do justice to logic, you have to be consistent. You can't on the one side say that the importation of these goods are injurious to your industry. And when measures are put in place to limit this influx, you are also saying that you are going to suffer. So I'm merely pointing out that in dealing with these issues, one, it becomes important to do what we sought to do here today. To pay particular attention to all these international protocols that the country engages in. What is the ramifications? DTI engages in international trade, enters into agreements. Those agreements do not come into force prior to them being ratified, going through the portfolio committee. That's us as members. After that process, it goes to the House. But the primary portfolio committee that would give direction to the House is this one. So I'm merely pointing out to our responsibility also to look critically at the agreements that are placed in front of us. And even after those agreements are ratified and have gone through Parliament, there's another leg that we need to give attention to. When they are implemented, are there unforeseen circumstances, unforeseen consequences that emanate from those agreements? And then to seek to address those unintended consequences. So I'm merely saying that this engagement should keep us alive to the complexity of all the issues. Engage them here, say that the definitions, how they apply, but what happens in reality. We take on board all those issues, but we need to look closely at the role of these, the presenters, and then vis-a-vis the DTI, and then carry out our functions. So this is good. It's a good engagement, but the blame should not be with the messenger. This is what I'm merely trying to say. Should look at the issue in its entirety and engage the department. We are going to have several units reporting to us, and at the end of this process, we are still going to have an engagement with the Department of Trade and Industry. So that's where we should also foreground these issues again when that opportunity arises. Thanks.
And I think we totally agree with you, but I think we also understand the purpose. That the presentation here to inform us how they will carry out the execution of or the administration of the policy. And I think within that we are saying do X, Y, Z, and we also asking questions as to how these particular things would be executed. It's not our intention to come and criticize and hit you after the idea.
That's perfectly clear, Comrade Wilson.
I think out of your remarks and perhaps the department, it could. There are two things, you know, often we get agreements that are presented having been negotiated by the department. And they brief us and say this and this and this. Now, you know, I'm not in business. The question I want to raise is when, before we ratify, or when the department signs an agreement, I'm looking at the process, do they consult the actors in the business community? It's almost like, you know, their clients, because their business community is actually their clients in a way. To say, we're going to sign this agreement, here it is, what do you people think about it? You know, is that done? Is it not? I don't know, you see. So, you know, you usually a public hearing before we ratify or something. Where does because the unintended consequences come from the practical application by people in business in South Africa. So where do they fit into this? So, and I agree, we're not shooting the messenger. The other question is, when we do raise issues, and which you quite rightly say, some of the issues are wider than just the specific mandate, because they have a mandate, this is your job description, you must apply this. So
But when issues, may I ask the department, when issues are raised that, you know, impact wider, that has caused us concern, does the specific unit take these concerns to the departmental executive or the minister and say, you know, we were there, and but these things came out of the committee, which are actually wider than our specific section units. So, is that done? Thank you.
Just a short reminder, Mr. Labuskasi. In terms of process, when matters are brought to us, the department is obliged to engage the stakeholders. So normally by the time we have a bill before the final stage, right at the end there, it's prescribed that they have to indicate all stakeholders that they consulted with. Consult, but I cannot say how wide they consult. But those are issues that we can always engage and ask for further information on. I'll now give the presenters an opportunity to engage.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to make a brief comment on the comments that members have made. The first thing is that China is one of the countries that are most acted against in terms of our instruments. It's the country that industry would approach us to act on. It would be followed by countries like India and Brazil. You would hardly get ITEC being approached by industry to act against imports, say, from the EU or from the US. And the question is, why? The answer to that question from our experience is that countries in Asia are countries that in terms of production have low cost compared to our cost of production. And so what we are seeing through these investigations is a competitiveness problem. Our stiff competition originates from these countries. And so rather than just focusing on the ITEC instruments, it does seem we need to look at a multifaceted strategy to deal with this problem of international competitiveness. I think the sector strategies that DTI is working on, and maybe possibly a strategy on China, would come in handy in terms of a multifaceted approach to the competition that we face from countries like China. Issues of, for example, in the textiles and clothing industry, equipment and machinery upgrade, skills, timeous delivery, quality, research and development. Now, the definition of dumping is that it takes place when a foreign country or firm exports to another at prices that are less than the prices they are selling at home. Now, specifically with China, previously, before China was granted market economy status by government, China was sort of, in terms of the anti-dumping instrument, treated as
guilty as charged. If industry approaches our predecessor, the DTT, to initiate an investigation, ultimately, the final finding would be that there is injurious dumping. That kind of treatment has changed with China having been granted market economy status. We've got to go to China, verify firms on a case-by-case basis, whether they are operating on free market principles or not. What we are finding is that they are operating on free market principles and that they are exporting their products to South Africa at the prices they are selling at home. The goods are cheap at home as they are cheap in South Africa. And again, this brings us to the question, the low cost of production compared to our cost of production. Just on the last issue on public interest, we are introducing in our regulations a clause on public interest. We might, as ITEC, find injurious dumping on a particular product. However, the minister might, in the public interest, decide not to accept the recommendation of ITEC and request ITEC to do a public interest investigation. An example would be, let's say we are approached by the steel industry and we find injurious dumping. But given the fact that now downstream industries in South Africa are faced by increasing cost of steel, minister might decide that because the anti-dumping duty would further increase prices of steel downstream, not to impose an anti-dumping duty. I must say that in cases where we find injurious dumping, I must say that the Commission acts swiftly to protect jobs and investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me thank our general manager for that response. I want to respond to some of the specific questions from Member Cheng. What we have roadshows. We've been to a number of provinces, and recently we had a workshop with BUSA, where all the industry was represented, and they have also agreed to assist us with sectors. So we explained to them the process of what happens. The example between us and the U.S., although we all use the WTO anti-dumping regulations, but we also have our own regulations. So what we do in the U.S. might not apply because in terms of our regulations and our legislation, that's why we've got the ITA Act. And how this industry, this international trade environment functions is that there are consultants that are employed by industry. So by the time industry comes to ITEC, it is not, for instance, a company in Cape Town. It is a consultant based in Pretoria who brings an application. So the consultants inform, at times misinform, industry. That is why the deliberate decision we have taken to engage industry directly to convince them, these are the instruments that ITEC uses. Also on that, on the issue of knowledge, it is very important. I think it cuts across our country. What is dumping in terms of the World Trade Organization? And like Sabrina has explained, it has to be injurious. And importantly, within that phrase, there must be a link between the dumping that is alleged and the injury. A company might show dumping of a product. Company A, we're making these bottles that are being dumped. We are suffering injury. However, upon investigation, we realize that they are suffering injury, but it is not because of the dumping. It is because they decided to merge with another company. Therefore, they are suffering as a consequence of that. we cannot reward bad management decisions. Government cannot be in a position to can reward bad management decisions. And people take decisions, then they come back to you and they say, please help us. In terms of the instrument that we have, there has to be dumping, there has to be injury, and there should be a causal link between the two. So my son, that you've got two factors, injury and dumping, but they're not related. So it happens in that. In terms of knowledge, we do go out and try and educate the industry out there. I think all the other questions Sabudela has, unless if there's one that we have missed, I think in his response he did touch on.
Okay. Thank you for your explanation. I have another question, that is, you say that is ITAC is carrying out a government policy. And so your presentation paper, that is page 3, you're talking about reduce production costs. So have you ever thought about, you know, how to reduce the production costs? Have you realized that we were saying that, you know, our electricity is the world's cheapest one, but our industry still has to buy wire, the electricity, and the power, you know, we pay really high, you know, that the electricity and water. Have you ever thought about to look on this issue? All right, and the other thing you're talking about the China, say, the textile and clothing company, they want to upgrade the machinery or the sphere to stop in South Africa. You know, my family do a little study about the textile, how the textile can survive in this country. There's one thing, I think the shortage of R&D, because of that is, did you realize that in all the boys, even in China, they have a lot of satellite processing the assistant, you know, there's subcontract, you know, the small factories who can help me to do the research and development. What I'm saying is that in this country, if any buyer asks you to develop one product, do you realize that the textile company, they have to stop the whole mass production lines, you know, to create it that young, and you're not guaranteed you can copy exactly. And you have to stop all your dyeing processing to dye the color to the buyer's required. And that is the thing that is usual. I think that is when the architect talking to the China, you must tell them the best way is that, you know, they have to put some investment here and to the R&D in China. And you know, and I know that most of the raw material also coming from China. How do we reduce the costing? It is if they are, you know, you get China partner there, and they can central buying to reduce all the raw material prices, and also do all the R&D in China. And just treating China as a South Korean as a very simple protecting base, you know, and they can choose, you know, what is the items, you know, the products they can do. Because at the moment, the other thing is that, you know, all R&D in the Far East, if you give them the yarn or fabric, anything to copy, they give you 2 days, you get it. In our country, it takes 2 months. So how can we compete? The speed is not there. 21 century is a speed competition. The speed you lost the whole market. And this is, I think, the ITAC, you know, maybe when you're talking to the China, forget about upgrade the machinery. First, maybe ask them to see if they can ask them to come to join venture with some kind of the textile or clothing here to do R&D the other side. Because at the moment, according to the statistics, we have almost 4 times investment in China than they're coming to us. And the other thing I want to raise is about, you know, this is, you're talking about a lot of just to say we protect the sapu, right? There's one question that is, you know, I heard a lot of crying from all the small countries, you know, when they imported the quota things, all right? Is this the sapu that it had to comply, to follow the import quota from China? Our, that is, the South African, we should go to also bilateral, the negotiate with individual SACO members, because we must be very careful, you know, this is, you know, whether it is against, you know, a SACO arrangement in between of the SACO, all the SACO members. And when we are going to have this, bilaterally, this product, do we invite the SACO members on board to ask how they are thinking about, you know, to assist us? Thank you.
Thank you. It's very clear that Professor Cheng is very passionate about this aspect. Mr. Lavaskas.
Can I just ask a question? Now, you know, when you get a dumping situation, you take a look at the other side and you check, you know, going to the question of subsidies, government support and so forth, which I understand. What is the approach? And coming back to like China textile, which is we were recently in China last year, and a delegation led by the Honorable Chairperson, yeah? And it was explained to us that the Chinese textile companies are now sort of on their own, and in fact that their profit margin is, I think, 3% was mentioned, and they, you know. But it was also told to us that for many, many, many years, the government supported the textile industry. So you see, now my question is, you now have a Chinese company producing and selling totally kosher, I mean, above all. But that company got maybe a 15-year government subsidy lead up, etc., to put it in a position now. Do you only look at by producing yarn X now at this situation, or do you say, but hang on, you know, you guys have had 15 years of government support, subsidy, and now you've grown up? Whereas our people have never had any of that. So you are placing, you know, you suddenly have, you've given a modern company, now you're competing. Is that fair competition because you've had 15, 20 years of subsidy and support to bring you up to now? Or is that discarded? You just look at the situation now. You produce an X, you sell an X.
Thanks. I'll take another round of questions. Nkosi, followed by Comrade Chisa Mentuli. Comrade Mark. Thank you, Chair, and honorable members. And I must also greet our distinguished guest from ITAC. First of all, Chair, I understand the core mandate from the Act that it is to encourage economic growth and employment in South Africa within the broader customs union. And as the first presenter of policy pointed out, through effective administration of the trade regulations. Now, on the issue of core business, I understand that in South Africa we do have business entities that are stimulating growth. There are also those international that have actually have direct investment in South Africa. All of them, of course, trying to boost the economy of our country. Now, in terms of the mandate within this international trade administration, is there any positive indication of growth there? Because I understand the growth from direct investment as well as from South Africa side. I'm not so clear whether, as a direct result of your core business, do receive growth, which no doubt should boost employment in the country as a direct result of that. And secondly, the question of the Constitutional Court case matter. Can you then unpack that a little bit? What are the issues there? What are the issues in that case? Their impact on your mandate? What is its effect? And when is it going to be disposed of, that case? I would like to check that again. And lastly, I think the lady question of dumping. Thank you for the definition. It's quite clear. The other issue, the perception from our own people, the question, I don't know whether I'm going to use the correct expression, the Hong Kong, the poor quality, that is actually being dumped here. Because I understand that, of course, the same quality wherever, in China, wherever, in South Africa. But what we come across is poor quality. And how is that controlled? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Nongonyan. Comrade Sisa.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Chair, I would like to understand a few things directly about ITEC, but also a couple of broader issues that one might say they inform ITEC's work, its roles and functions. The first one is I would like to focus on the nature and character of ITEC. Having read the brochure that has been given to us and listened attentively, which I thank the ITEC management for that, still one would like to understand a little bit about ITEC. Sorry, one may have not been able to get it clear from the presentation or having, if one may have had an opportunity to look at the act itself. Is ITEC a technical institution or a policy formulation institution or a regulatory institution? I'm sorry if my question is a bit crude, but I had to pick up terms, you know, just to provoke thinking, because, I mean, if you compare where are you located? Because even the Koti group is sort of categorized as a real grouping. And if you look at Project 3, 9 and 23 in this small brochure, something arose in my mind. To what extent can we still maintain, or would I be right if I would say ITEC is sort of a techno developmental institution? Sorry, it's not product 3, 9, and 23. It's pages 3, pages 9, and 23. For example, in page 3, the purpose of product number 3 is about promoting of manufacturing activities in SACU. One sees that as more developmental than anything. And also in page 9, the other input for product 9 is the first to contribute to economic growth and development of staff. So you'll appreciate why I was keen to understand that. The other one is also to what extent does it play a tribunal role? Because complaints are submitted, to what extent does it have a muscle to meet out the punitive measures? And one other question I had, which I suppose has been sort of clarified, I hope so. To what extent does ITEC balance its pro and reactive, or a pro and versus reactive character in its function? On one side, I thought, ITEC is a reactive institution, but then, I was going to ask to what extent does it look into the second economy, particularly creating an awareness campaign for people to know how to send the second economy to lodge complaints. But then it was answered that you have road maps and the road shows and stuff. That question is answered. But still, my question is now, how do you balance the two? Because one must assume you still have to be a reactive institution. Maybe if you could help us a little bit around how you formulate your internal policy. I was looking at things as the custom tariff policy. Chair, one other thing I was keen to know is that ITEC is part of this broad range of agencies. And assuming that it's much more regulatory, though I still want to be corrected or confirmed on that, one sort of TISA, State Investment South Africa, which tries to encourage investment into South Africa, that triggers in trade and all stuff. To what extent does it interact with the TISA and even SARS? Reference is made to those institutions, but it's not clear as to how they work with those institutions. Another area is, does ITEC play any role during negotiations with within WTO processes and even generally trade agreements? So you'll understand why I was sort of focusing on the nature and character of ITEC. I may have a couple of other questions, may just be answered by that, you know. And also, I looked at the minister's forward in the report. There are a number of issues that are unusually expected in a forwarding that, you know, where the minister is raising certain issues, drawing the attention of ITEC. I assume that those issues are raised because of the independent nature of ITEC. But also, then it triggers one question, how does then ITEC interact with the ministry? Not necessarily the minister, but with the ministry generally. Thanks.
Comrade Sisa, thank you. Comrade Mendel.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two questions. On page 9 of the presentation, there's a safeguard action and what to prove. You talk about serious injuries and threats and the causality. Now, when you get a dumping complaint or allegations of dumping or counterfeiting, you talk about serious injuries, and you said there are 14 various economic sectors that you are looking at, and you said some of them you say they are not all positive, meaning that some are negative. Now, if you can unpack this a little bit for us to understand what type of economic factors you're talking about, and which ones are serious and which ones are not having serious or negative effects. The last one will be, maybe if you can educate my mind on the relationship that you are having between yourself and the Competition Commission. Are you not duplicating each other's work? What is happening here? Or are you working together so that I can understand what is happening? I just wanted to know those two issues. Thank you.
Mentally, thank you very much, Comrade Mate.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. I'm not very sure whether my question would be, I'll be asking the question to the relevant agency here. I've got a tendency of thinking like a peasant, in order to understand some of these things. You see, in my constituency, almost all those village shops, corner shops, and Giani, what might be called a sort of a town there, all the shops there are owned more or less by foreigners. And the goods that they sell, 99.9999%, are sort of Chinese goods. From a pencil, I can see I'm having a Chinese pencil with me here. Yeah? Let alone the The T-shirts of Construction Day of Congress also have got the tag of China. So, in such a situation, where does the ITEC come in? Those goods there are Chinese goods. Even the owners, meaning that if some of the owners of the shops now are Chinese, what actually happened? What situation do we have? Are they taking the goods straight from home? And they even own the shops here. So if somebody could unpack that to a layman like myself, with a present mind, so that next time I can be able to go and explain to my constituents who are complaining about that very situation. Thank you very much.
Chair, follow my mind. Of course, Chair, I forgot just a question that's linked to the nation character. Master Chair, it is around the conceptual framework that guides ITEC when it compiles or even judges work. A few terms that have come up that make me, you know, ask this question, and as I say, it's linked with the nature and character of ITEC. If you look at things there are terms like fair trade, enhancement of competitiveness, as well as trade liberalization or management thereof, it that would be helpful to see how does the ITEC see those terms and how are they define, not that we should not know that, but to what extent have they taken them on board, you know, when they look at trade remedies, tariff amendments and investigation, and all of that. But it's terms that come up throughout the presentation, even in their annual report. Thanks, sir.
Comrade Marke, I don't pretend to preempt the reply that you will receive from the presenters. But one aspect of your contribution might be best placed at the door of the Home Affairs Portfolio Committee. How the Chinese have arrived in your village and have put up shop there. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Fenton. We'll have a number of people responding, but I'd just like to say, to preface this by saying that ITEC still has not presented its two other main core areas of work. And some of the questions might begin to touch there. So we'll respond here, but we request that we also have two other areas, and that is where we can be in the position to respond to our questions. We have a number of questions, some of them legal, some of them policy. I'll ask the different managers to respond. I'll just ask them to respond.
Thank you, Chair. I'll combine the question on how ITEC contributes to reducing the cost of production with the question on how ITEC contributes to economic growth. ITEC does, through its instruments, contribute to economic growth and employment. But the difficulty is how to measure this contribution and put a number to it. Now, if you look at our trade remedies instrument, the way we apply them now, we are more circumspect than they have been applied before. Instead of looking at the applicant only, we look at the value chain. We look at the wider economic interest. And what that means is that for upstream products that are used as inputs downstream, we wouldn't impose if there is not a strong case of injurious dumping. We do so that downstream manufacturers can source their inputs at internationally competitive prices. There's more value addition, and there's manufacturing domestically. And one would assume, therefore, employment, investment. We also, in terms of ordinary customs duties, the approach is to reduce duties upstream so as to lower the cost of production downstream. We also use these instruments to protect domestic industries where there is economic justification for protection of jobs and investment. We would use anti-dumping duties. We would use countervailing measures. We would use an increase in an ordinary customs duty to protect domestic manufacturers. But there's got to be economic justification for that. In terms of our import and export control measures, we have restrictions on second-hand goods. In fact, for clothing and textiles, there's a complete ban on second-hand goods. If these goods were to be allowed to come in to the domestic market, they would erode further the market that domestic manufacturers hold. So what I'm trying to say here is that in terms of our core functions, we do have quite a significant contribution in terms of promoting growth and employment. The other instruments that we have in the presentations that are going to come, Brenda will speak on it. We have an instrument called rebates, which is a temporary waiver on duties on imported imports for the manufacturer domestically for purposes of exporting the product. The question on the nature of ITEC. Well, ITEC is an administrative body established in terms of the ITER Act. It makes recommendations to the minister. The minister makes the decisions, which are then conveyed to Minister of Finance and finally implemented by the South African Revenue Service. ITEC is directly accountable in terms of the act to the minister. The broad policies, trade and industrial policy, are set by the DTI. We develop operational policies within those bigger picture policies. And our operational policies are the customs tariff policy, the anti-dumping policy, and import and export control policy. These are developed internally and are submitted to our minister for approval. There is an interface between these operational policies and the bigger picture policies. It's difficult to have a watertight wall between the administrative role that ITEC plays and the role played by the relevant divisions of the DTI on trade and industrial policy. So there is that interconnectedness. However, the lead divisions, the custodians of trade and industrial policy, are the relevant divisions of the DTI. How our work relates to the Competition Commission. There is a relationship. The Competition Commission looks at, amongst other things, price differentiation in the domestic market. We look at price differentiation across borders. Now, something interesting about what we do and what the competition does is the Competition Commission would regard price fixing domestically as an uncompetitive behavior. However, in terms of anti-dumping, we have a clause that's called price undertaking, wherein a domestic manufacturer enters into an agreement with an exporter. The exporter undertakes not to export at prices less than they are selling at home. They fix the price. Quite an interesting comparison. And of course, in terms of the quota institutions, we fall under the category of regulatory bodies, together with the Competition Commission. I think some of the questions that have been raised are going to become clearer when we go into the other two presentations on the call, because we've just dealt only with anti-dumping. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We had a question on the constitutional case. I would like the senior manager to answer. And I think Chair has covered the policy process. But if there's any addition from Alexander, but I'd like Nikki to give a broad outline of what the case is about. Thank you. Without going into too much detail.
Thank you, Jay. I think in terms of Article 6 of the ITA Act, the Minister of Trade and Industry may issue a notice restricting imports and exports into South Africa. Either try to be banning it, or otherwise saying that you need an import permit to bring something in, or an export permit to export something. As you know, the Chinese quota, we are administering that through import and export control, and we also have several other import restrictions that we are administering. We're now having a case that's pending in a constitutional court where the constitutionality of restricting imports of Article 6 is being challenged. I think the idea, we will see if we receive the papers in full, but the idea of this case is that Article 6 is unconstitutional because Article 23 of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, is saying that everyone in South Africa has a freedom of trade, so that by restricting trade, the minister is actually now acting unconstitutionally. So the case is only the beginning phase, so as it goes on, we will see how that goes. I have to say that this has been challenged before, when it was still import and export, the Act on Import and Export Control. It was in the interim constitution, and at that stage was also challenged the minister's right to restrict imports, and the court actually refused the application. They said it's not unconstitutional. So we will see what happens now with the new case. Thanks.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I would like to make a suggestion. Mr. Labuschagne, pose your question, but I'm not going to allow the answer thereof. My very cheap watch says it's 11:05. After you have posed your question, recommend that we have a body tea break for about 10 minutes and then come back. They might be able to answer your question then, or perhaps if it links to the other presentations that have to be made, then they'll answer it at the subsequent time. Please pose your question.
Thank you. I take note of the fact that you are an administrative organ. I was just wondering, are you very much then in a straight jacket? Or how flexible are you? You know, because when I read your mission, it says, and this relates, you know, to fair trade, because dumping we know it's technical and something else is technical, and then you have fair trade. And I suppose you'll come to the answer of how far back when the Chinese get it. And it says, your mission is creating an enabling environment for fair trade. Now, this is what gets me. Through customs, tariff amendments, trade remedies, and import and export control. So, are you very much, you know, I mean, we can be cross, but in your mandate is in here. There's no good me getting cross with you because that's all you're allowed to do. So, you know, I just want to know, you know, how much of a straitjacket are you in, and do you have flexibility? Thank you.
Okay. I'll allow
a response, immediate response to that because of the nature of the question.
I think the simple answer would say that we are a straight jacket. We've got flexibility, but within the instruments. And also to hasten to add, Chairperson, that ITEC, I think, is the only institution in the world that actually has these three tools under one roof. We have done benchmarking exercises. You've got one in other countries, a unit that will deal with tariff amendments separate, trade remedies separate. So we are the one institution that only deals with all three. And we do have difficulties in terms of the different units that are mandates as well. It is challenging, but we are an administrative body. Our only flexibility is applying the policies Tabuyela has clearly amplified, the broad government policies within our mandate and with our operational policies that we have. Thank you.
Thank you very much on that note of flexibility within confines. Good folks, as I said, my chip watch says it's 10 past 11 now. So following 10 minutes, let's have some tea, body break, and then we commence. Thanks.
I'll start on the 14 economic factors. I would like to ask my colleague to respond. Secondly, I've just been informed that our projector has suddenly gone dead. Is it possible that you could continue, but if members could use the handouts that we have in the meantime, while waiting for the technician? Thank you.
Thank you, Kay. Just to talk a bit about the economic factors, I didn't want to bore the members, so I didn't list them all, but... So let me just quickly talk about them. They're the normal economic factors that a business would run on. Just to mention a few, on the price effect, we would look at price undercutting, depression, separation, the normal price factors. And then we also look at things like sales, production, employment, wages, inventories, those type of factors we look at. And in my presentation, I referred to it, and maybe I was not totally clear. It depends on the company that we're investigating or the industry that we're investigating. So, say in a very, like glass, for example, you take the glass example, they can't afford to slow down production. So no matter what happens in the market, it's a continuous process, so they keep on manufacturing. So the injury factors there would not necessarily be a decline in sales or a decline in production. They would attempt to reduce the price in order to keep the volume. So in the glass industry, for instance, the injury would be a price injury. Other industries that can slow down production and that are more based on keeping the price, getting the profit, they might have not price and profit injury, but they will see a decline in production and a decline in sales. So all of them are equally important, but it depends on the industry that you're looking at, which factors will show whether there's injury or no injury.
Continue, ma'am. They are here to sort out your projector.
She says that she is done. I don't know.
Come again. We just say we are going to continue with the presentation while they are sorting out the overhead projector.
Thank you, Chair. I will be presenting on the import and export control unit. And if we look at assumptions, that is controlling the importation and exportation of particular goods for specific reasons. The purpose is, like I think to some extent it's already been referred to, also support sustainable industrialization and job creation.
The legal framework is the International Trade Administration Act, and in particular Section 6, which has also been referred to by Nikki. This legislation is empowering legislation, enabling the minister to pass or to issue regulations with regard to import control and export control. So indeed, we have approved regulations published during 2003 and 2002 respectively with regard to import and export control. And we also have policies, like Chevalier has indicated, these are the operational policies, providing us the framework within we adjudicate the permit applications. Then when we look at the importation of, or import side of import and export control, there is a broad distinction made between new goods, used and second-hand goods, and waste and scrap. South Africa operates in a multilateral arena, meaning that we have to comply with WTO rules and that we cannot introduce non-tariff barriers in instances where there is no provision really in the WTO for doing so. The result is that a limited number of new goods are subject to import control measures. So if we look at the new goods subject to control measures and we look at the purpose, we'll find it being for health and environment. Mr. Mling also mentioned initially that there is a lot of cooperation between the import and export control unit of ICAC and other government departments. So with regard to health and environment, there is cooperation between ourselves, for instance, and the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, South African Bureau of Standards. Then we also control for the purpose of international agreements. Here we, for instance, would think about things like the Montreal Protocol, which talks about the importation of chemicals with an ozone depleting potential. There's also cooperation between ourselves and Environmental Affairs, who are the owners or the signatories to the convention or the protocol. Then we also control for strategic reasons. An example here is, for instance, fossil fuels, cooperation between ourselves and the Department of Minerals and Energy. Then another purpose for control is for quality and safety, cooperation between ourselves and the South African Bureau of Standards. Then also for safety and security, cooperation between ourselves and the South African Police Service. An example here is, for instance, importation of firearms and ammunition. Then also we control for purpose of social reasons and for quality. For instance, the importation of gambling machines and devices. Cooperation between ourselves and the National Gambling Board. Then we get to the importation of used and second-hand goods. Now, there's a general rule, and that is basically that if something is manufactured in South Africa and available, then import permits are not issued for the importation of the used substitute or equivalent. It is expected of proposed importers or companies wanting this product to first source it from local manufacturers. There are various reasons that people would want to import second-hand goods. Usually it becomes available in affluent societies at very low prices. It distorts the local manufacturing industry and job creation that is embedded in the industry. In many instances, some of the products became obsolete in the countries of use or origin. It comes available onto the market, and people would want to import it, finding out that after it's been imported, that there's a lot of malfunction. So we are trying to keep those out of the market where there's local manufacturing in the first instance. However, we do realize that in very specifically defined circumstances, we need to allow the importation of certain used and second-hand goods, mainly for raw materials or as raw materials for manufacturing purposes. Then the waste and scrap, where it also gets the imports. Control is exercised for environmental and health reasons mainly. Usually the accumulation of waste and scrap internationally is a problematic phenomenon. The accumulation exceeds the recycling program, so there's always a need for countries to dispose of waste and scrap. The basic driver is the Basel Convention. Now,
This is also the Department of Environmental Affairs, a signatory to the convention. There's a close relationship between ourselves and the Department of Environmental Affairs. So we will not allow waste and scrap to be imported unless it's within the confines or the ambit of the convention. It is also allowed in cases where it serves the purpose of being a raw material, for instance, waste paper, waste glass, ferrous waste and scrap, and so on, when there are local food shortages. That brings us to the export control part. Export control is basically maintained for beneficiation. There's a number of programs run, for instance, by the Department of Trade and Industry to try and promote beneficiation of, for instance, metals and minerals before it's exported. And our function is to try and assist in this regard, specifically the Department of Minerals and Energy. And also, as in the case of import control, we control the exportation of certain goods in terms of international agreements, like I've mentioned, the Montreal Protocol or the 88 Convention, which deals with chemicals that can be used in illegal drug manufacturing. Once again, coordination between ourselves or cooperation with ourselves and the South African Police Service. We also maintain export control to make sure that certain crucial raw materials are not exported and leaving South African recyclers or manufacturers with shortages, such as, once again, ferrous and non-ferrous waste and scrap. Then also export control measures in place to assist strategies of crime prevention. Here we, for instance, assist South African Police Service. We think about, in this regard, the exportation of used vehicles to make sure that stolen vehicles do not leave the country. We have export control permit system in place. Then we also control for the purpose of, or for strategic reasons. That's once again similar to the import control measures, that's the fossil fuels, to ensure that there's always sufficient quantities available in South Africa. Excuse me, cooperation with the Department of Minerals and Energy. Then we have also an activity of enforcement. This means that we conduct inspections to ensure that there is compliance with conditions in permits. We also conduct investigations to detect contraventions of conditions and of legislation. We also have the power of seizure of illegally imported goods or goods destined for export. Then in general, we have certain electronic systems in place. There are no hard copy permits. It's all electronic processing, electronic messages that go directly to the South African Revenue Services. We have a reporting function, a database where we can see the use of permits. Then our application forms and information is posted on the web, so it's easy accessible. Then just a little bit of statistics. For instance, in the 2005-2006 financial year, we received 29,000 permit applications. We issued 17,800 import permits and 3,900 export permits. And then also, it's also been referred to that the administration of the MOU that the government has with the PRC, this is being done as a project, disseminating the quota allocations to importers. This is all provided for in regulations, once again approved by the minister, and this is a project that will run for this year and 2008. And that is important export control here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sleman. Next presenter, and then take comments and questions thereafter.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to make a presentation with regards to the work that is done by Tariff Investigation, and I'm representing Tariff Investigations 1 and 2. This unit actually conducts custom tariff investigation on behalf of the Commission, and this entails doing rigorous research, gathering of information and data that is presented to the Commission, and is presented in a way that enables the commission to make decisions or informed decisions. The core responsibilities of the unit are twofold, and that is to do the customs tariff amendments and the administration of the customs rebates, which I'm going to allude to in the proceeding slide. What then do we mean by tariff amendments? These are the amendments of customs duty applicable to important imported products or a product and imported products. Tariffs may be amended from time to time, and most of the amendments are industry driven. That is, we get applications from industry. However, it does happen sometimes that some of these amendments or applications are initiated by either ITEC or the Southern African Revenue Services, SARS. The amendments can be of three types. Under exceptional circumstances, as a relief for industries that may be experiencing threatening imports, the Commission may recommend, or an industry may apply for an increase in duty. But this happens under exceptional circumstances is not quite often. A decrease in duty. In most cases, a reduction is preferred, given the overall trend towards a phasing down of duties and elimination of duties over time. And a reduction would be most preferred in cases where there is no justification for protection. And this is one area where we often receive a lot of applications from industry. It also happens sometimes that there is a need to create a rebate. However, this is often avoided, as it is often not easy to administer, and neither does it encourage transparency and consistency. I will make an example. There are cases where you find that too many products are classified under one tariff heading, and you find that the industry wants to apply for a product that is classified under that tariff heading, and that product might be of a specific nature. For instance, you find that in that tariff heading, they talk of steel of 35 centimeters, and you find that the industry needs a product that is probably steel of 30 centimeters. In such a case, it might not be necessary to reduce the duty, but it might be appropriate, that is, if justified, to create a temporary rebate just to accommodate that specific industry or specific product. Therefore, a rebate can be created to accommodate a specific product or a specific industry, and it's usually of temporary nature. I said that the unit actually looks at two core responsibilities. I've just finished the one on customs duty amendment. We also administer rebates and drawbacks. What then are these rebates and drawbacks? This is a waiver provided for the domestic industries not to pay customs duties. It's actually an exemption from duty. It's temporary in nature, and I think the general manager did allude to that prior. It actually allows sourcing of inputs at competitive prices, especially on inputs that are not produced or insufficiently produced domestically. And the waiver enables the manufacturer to import their inputs at reduced cost and encourages them to be able to export. I now go on to look at the assessment criteria in terms of what is our basis of either recommending a rejection or an approval of an application on a customs tariff amendment. Firstly, we do look at whether the product or the substitute product being applied for, whether it's manufactured in the Southern African Customs Union or not. And it is important to note that all our investigations or recommendations are evidence-based. Thus, there is thorough research and investigations in terms of verifying the information that is presented to the Commission by the industry. And thus, we have to make sure that the product being applied for or the product in subject is not available in SWAKU. And if it is not available in SWAKU, it is often found appropriate not to protect, and rather a reduction may be recommended. We also look at the competitiveness position of the product concerned or being applied for. And that is in terms of cost-raising effect and the cost of doing business for that applicant. We also look at the effective rate of protection. This means that we do not only take into account the duty that is being paid on the end product, that is the nominal rate of protection, but we also take into consideration the duty that is paid on the inputs required to manufacture that product and the process then added. We also look at the calculation of the percentage of the duty rate in relation to the factory selling price of the product. That is the cost burden of the duty. We also look at the production factors and market factors. That is the relative market share of the product, for instance. It is also important that whatever recommendations we make on the amendment, they do not appear to complicate the tariff structure. It is important that we keep the tariff structure simple, transparent, and easy to administer. Thus, consideration is often taken as to whether the proposed tariff amendment will be easy to administer, especially by the customs people or South African Revenue Services. It is for this reason that the Commission often prefers recommending a reduction as opposed to creating a rebate or an increment, which is often difficult to administer. And most of all, it is important that we take into consideration the value of the investment and the employment to be created by that application. You may then ask yourself as to why the tariff investigations instruments are important. I'm going to now explain the role of this instrument, that is the tariff investigation instrument. The key role of the instrument is to, one, facilitate normal trade. A presentation has been given on trade remedy instruments, which are often used on unfair trade, whilst the tariff instruments are used to facilitate normal trade and show competitiveness of local industries. In terms of trade liberalization, the South African economy has undergone substantial high-level restructuring since 1994, and notably the opening of South Africa to the world trade. That is, South Africa is moving away from protectionism and looking at encouraging gradual phasing down of duties or zero duties. The instruments are therefore in support of this drive, and it is in support of the DTI policies in this regard on issues of trade liberalization. Thus, in terms of our latest industrial policy, the trend is to reduce duties upstream whilst maintaining a certain duty for downstream value addition. In terms of compliance with trade agreements, the extent to which amendments are made is limited by the trade agreements and arrangements that South Africa has with other countries, such as the WTO, SADC, UNSACO, and Mercosur, and the EU. For instance, we need to be alert to the fact that specific duties cannot exceed the WTO boundaries. If there is an application for an increase, it is important to also look at whether we will not be violating the WTO agreement in terms of that increment, because it is limited to the WTO boundary. There are instances where you may want to even reduce the duty, but you also have to take into consideration the trade agreements that South Africa has with other countries. And we may not impose duties in certain instances, depending on those arrangements that South Africa has in terms of free trade agreements. The functions of the unit are done within set legal frameworks, and namely the ITER Act, which has been alluded to, more specifically the ITER Act of 2002, which provides for the amendment of the customs duty. The Customs and ISO Act of 1964, especially Part 1 of Schedule 1. The Customs Tariff Policy, which actually sets out the parameters within which ICAC executes its mandate, and it is interlinked to the trade and industrial policy. Tariff investigation has two units, that is Tariff 1 and 2, with each focusing on specific sectors, and as you may see, that the Tariff 1 unit, which is represented by Mrs. Judy Mofuken, focuses on the chemicals, textiles, and other processing sector. While Tariff Investigation 2, which is managed by me, focuses on the metals, machinery, and the motor industry sector. The two units actually do the one and the same work. The only difference is the focus on the specific sectors. There are two flagship projects of ITEC which are administered by the two units. You will note that South Africa has got substantial support to the automotive sector and the textile industry. Thus, we administer the duty credit certificate scheme, which is currently known as the Textile and Clothing Industry Development Program, and we also manage the Motor Industry Development Program, MIDP, both of which the policies are set by the DTI, and we offer the administration support of those programs. They are both currently under review. The process that we follow administering the customs tariff application. I will not go through each process, but I will quickly say that, as I indicated, that most of the applications that we receive often come from industry. We assess the applications, and if we feel that there is a need for it to initiate based on the information given, there is a preliminary investigation that is done, and the findings of which are tabled to the commission for decision making. And the commission may decide to publish for further investigation, that is public comment. Or if there isn't sufficient information to justify further investigation, then the investigation may be terminated. There is also the process of publication, that is the Gazette. The period taken is often 4 weeks for a reduction and 6 weeks for an increase. Following the gazetting of the investigation, the findings are also tabled back to the Commission for final determination, of which the results are then given to the minister for his consideration, that is the Minister of Trade and Industry, who then gives an instruction to the Minister of Finance if it is found to be appropriate. And it is then directed for implementation. The overall time frame for processing of the application is often 4 to 6 months for a reduction and 6 to 8 months for an increase, because it's often very complicated and requires more work. I've included statistics which show how many applications we receive and how many we approve and reject for the years 2004, 2003 up to 2006. The statistics show that for 2004, it shows what was rejected and approved or even withdrawn, because it does happen that some of the applications are withdrawn if there is insufficient information or after further discussions with the applicant finds it appropriate to withdraw. I will go to the next slide. It actually talks to that table, because in a table format, it might not tell a story. The graph actually alludes to the figures that I indicated in the above table. And what can be said about those figures is that in terms of, it actually alludes to our drive to ensure that we move towards trade liberalization. You may see that the increases in duty are less in 2004 as compared to 2005, which means that there is less protectionism. While the reductions in duty were high in 2004-2005 as compared to 2003-2004, and this shows the drive towards phasing down of duties over time. So the trend is towards reducing duties. That is all I can say about tariff investigations, and our information for application is available in our website, although we are also available for consultation, and we can always avail information on tariff investigation applications by post if requested.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
There's only two parts, so can she continue the next part?
The other part that we all would also like to present on is in terms of what is the responsibility of ITEC regarding the Southern African Customs Union, the agreement that was signed by South Africa with Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Swaziland. In terms of this agreement, especially Article 7 of the Success Agreement, it states that there will be a need for democratization of SACU, and this will be done through the establishment of certain institutions. In terms of this agreement, then, it means that the common external tariff will be managed by the SACU institutions which are going to be established. And critical to ITEC is the establishment of this institution, because it has a lot of relevance to the work that ITEC is currently doing. Just to give you an overview of the SACU institutions that are to be established. Currently, there are the technical liaison committees, which actually look at technical issues and present to the Commission, who then presents to the Council of Ministers. However, it is anticipated that there will be establishment of national bodies, and that is independent bodies or designated institutions, which will be entrusted with receiving applications, investigate, and make recommendations to the tariff board. You will note that currently in the Southern African Customs Union, it is only South Africa that does the work that should be done by the national bodies. That's our interest in the process, because it will have a lot of implications in the manner that we are doing our work currently. There will be the tariff board, and the tariff board will consist of experts that will be drawn from member states, who shall be full-time or part-time, or both, and they shall make recommendations to the Council of Ministers. The Council of Ministers will actually consist of at least one member from each member state, and the Council of Ministers will be responsible for the overall policy direction and functioning of the SACU institutions, including the formulation of policies, the mandates, procedures, and guidelines for these institutions. There is the Secretariat, which is currently based in Namibia, and it supports the establishment of these institutions and the day-to-day running of the SACU. I will briefly take you through the process, the SACU process, in light of the fact that I've indicated that once the SACU institution has been established, it will actually mean we have to follow a different route when we receive applications from industry. The national bodies, as I indicated, that there will be independent institutions which will actually do the same work as ITEC does now, will receive applications from industry. And instead of the applications going to our Minister of Trade and Industry, for instance, they will be taken to the SACU Tariff Board. That is the recommendations that should be made by the national institutions or the national bodies will be given to the SACU Tariff Board, and the SACU Tariff Board will then recommend to the Council of Ministers, who will make a final decision. Should there be deadlocks or disagreements on those decisions, that there will be a tribunal that will actually look at arbitrating all differences. The Council of Ministers will be advised by commission or senior officials who will be experts in their own rights. So overall, what that process means that is that in terms of the work that ISEC does, it will actually change the manner in which we carry our work, which is why it is important for us to participate in the process of the establishment of the SACU institution. ISEC, because of its experience, and as the only national body currently, which is operational in SACU, it has been instrumental in the development of annexes for the establishment of this institution. It is important to note that whilst you are looking at the fact that SACU is looking at establishing the national body, we also consider the roadmap that has been set by SACU in terms of when they want things to happen. How realistic it is, I will not be able to answer that. SACU has set the roadmap, and it is anticipated that the establishment of the national bodies will be done by September 2007, and these national bodies will be operational by January 2008. It is expected that the experts who will serve on the tariff board will be nominated by February 2007. And the commencement of training for the tariff board members will actually commence by February 2007 as well. The establishment of the tariff board will be done by September 2008 again and become operational by 2008. What actually this means then is that after all this has been achieved, ITEC mandate might have to change. That is the manner in which we do our work. The challenge is, therefore, for us to realize that. One, as I indicated, that currently South Africa is the only country amongst the member states, the sub-member states, that has a national body. It leaves a lot of questions in terms of whether the other member states, Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Namibia, will have the capacity to carry out this terrorist investigation. However, we currently have people that have been nominated from the different member states who are currently with ITEC for training in terms of how we do our work, and it is expected that by the time these people return to their countries, they will be competent enough to advise on the customs terrorist investigations and trade remedies issues. The training, we have two members from each member state, and for terrorist investigations it's 12 months, and for trade remedies it's 18 months. The training commence actually started in July last year. Article 38 of the SACU agreement actually requires that SACU develop a common industrial policy. And the challenge is whether these policies will be completed or done by 2008, when the new national institutions are expected to be up and operational. One of the challenges is having to map the current industrial policy and policy instruments of the different member states, noting the diverse economic structures of the sub-member states. It is important to note that all decisions that will be made by the Council of Ministers or the national bodies and the terrorist bodies will have to be based on clearly agreed, understood, and communicated policy guidelines. Hence the need for the development of common policies. But the question is, how are these policies going to be developed, and when, and whether it is possible to meet the deadline of 2008? In the absence of these common policies, then it would be difficult to have the SACU institutions operating, because what do they base their decisions on?
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you, Chairperson. From our side, I think that's the last question.
Honorable members, that's the second component of the presentation. Comments, questions? Mr. Marke, comrade, you're first, followed by Mr. Labaskasni, Men Tuli, comrade Lal.
Thank you, comrade. I think the presentation was very clear. I think I've got an idea of the functions and objectives of ITEC. Just one question. I'm still interested in the question of the public interest. It has been explained to me very clearly. But if I marry it with what was very interesting for me, was that there's some clause that says that import licenses might be denied if the product or the goods that is produced, for goods that are produced in South Africa, that is, in order to protect those goods that the country produces. I think that instrument for me is a very effective one. And I wonder why it's not used in textile. If I was listening very carefully, if that exists, that some companies might be denied import licenses, And at least we've got an instrument here. And I would say, in the public interest, referring to loss of jobs, I wonder if that combination makes sense in terms of the technical work that ITEC is doing. But in my layman's language, that makes sense. If I was to repeat it, import licenses are denied for goods that are produced in South Africa in the public interest, referring to job losses, which would be for our worker. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Mike. Mr. Labaskakhni.
Well, I'm going to take on Mr. Snyman again. The question, my bugbear, and I don't know if there's a way around it, but this, I suppose this is a... I'm fully aware, out of practical experience, that the prohibition on second-hand clothing, and I fully accept and understand. And perhaps, of course, I've had two cases where charitable organizations abroad have gathered clothing for the poor, you know, in South Africa, and then they can't import them. And I realize the reasoning, I fully understand the reasoning, because there's been abuse. I don't know, and then I had a case where the stuff was stuck, and then I think customs sold the clothes to pay for the tariff, and the marriage, or, you know, the story. In fact, the clothes, second-hand clothes ended up being sold. All right, by customs. Is this, now, you know, if you have two cases, you think you're the only person on the block. Are there many applications, you know, for this type of thing? And if it's really very few, is there not some way, and who and how decides this? And is there no way of, when you do have a bona fide case, like a church or Lions or Rotary service organization, you know, to get some sort of assistance, because they don't sell, they distribute. Of course, on the other hand, when you talk about charities, we've just been reading about Mama Jack up in Joburg, so the charity would have been another story. And whether, I gathered at the time, you know, in a national disaster, they would allow it. But we had a case in Cape Town, for example, when it wasn't a national disaster, you know, when the fires were here and the shacks were burnt down. Is there not some way where we can, you know, reach an accommodation? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Labaskakhni. Mantuli?
Thank you, Dr. Sir. I think it's on page 20 where you talk about the role of the instrument. You talk about the trade liberalization, and that the substantial or the very high level of restructuring has been made in South Africa. We are moving away from protection. But coupled that is what my comrade here, Mike, was talking about, the import licenses that were denied. I don't know whether can you just explain that to me. Now, you talk about facilitating normal trade. I don't know whether in reality there's something like normal trade. If you talk about compliance with the trade agreement's obligations, and also about the WTO agreements that must not be violated, I don't know how true is this. Because to me, it relates only to developing countries, not developed countries. Because developed countries can do whatever they want. We seem not to be knowing what is happening in the green room. We can discuss and do whatever we want to do, but the other decisions are taken in the green room. Now, how how much teeth you have to can put your foot down and say we are all not violating the WTO agreements or the trade agreements that we have bilateral countries and so forth. How effective are you? Can you stand here in front of us and say, yes, we have peace, or you just make recommendations and it ends there? I just ask that question, sir.
Mantuli, my default is also bright. Comrade Lang.
Thank you. My question would be on page, on slide number 24, page 2, I suppose, or page 12. Of Mr. Sneman's presentation. Firstly, correct me if I'm wrong, whether in terms of the import and export, you are also linking or dealing with the agricultural stuff. If yes, particularly on slide 24 under health and environment, whether in your control on whatever entrances, the whole provinces, are you able to determine the goods which are coming inside the country which are either GMO or not GMO stuff? The reason I'm asking this question under health and environment is because in certain circumstances we find that some of the stuff are not labeled, and if they are not labeled, therefore you won't be able to determine whether they are GMO or not. I don't think you can please address us on that particular issue. The other issue on slide 23, under the distinction between new goods, whatever, waste and scrap, just want to check whether do you accept the waste or scrap in terms of your input? Well, I'm raising this issue because it has been said in a number of occasions that Africa in particular is becoming a dumping zone for the European country, in particular your states, United States of America, and Europe, of course. Then the other issue, Chairperson, will be on page 26, on slide number 52, from Ms. Mabas, I suppose, under challenges. You refer to the blend of common policies, I suppose, the take of the subject or within AU countries. What I want to check here, how far are you with the development of those policies? And what are the challenges that you are facing in terms of developing those policies? Because in certain respects, you find that there are certain committees within AU that are not meeting. I don't know whether within your jurisdiction you are able to meet if needs be. The last one, the question will be on page 20. That will be your slide number 40. Again, on Ms. Mombasa's presentation, under legal framework, you talk about the Customs and Excise Act of 1964. So I'm raising this, whether that act is still relevant or as any amendment that has been amended in this. You know, just I'm raising this issue because I was shocked when I hear from another committee, I think it was communication, when they had the 1960 Act and they didn't know about that act. They didn't even know about that at all. And even the DGs and DGs were shocked, you know, to discover that particular legislation. So I just want to check if this is still relevant in terms of our operation, or has maybe it just been amended in terms of the amendment as supposed to be. Thanks very much, sir.
Comrade Lally, thank you very much. Comrade Danny, what is that?
Just a small question. On the question of TACO, it's been presented here that given the challenges on the capacity of the member states, South Africa is the only country that's really organized. So we're a dominant force within SACU. Now I just want to, because said here on the pre, the previous slide that, you know, training will be given. But isn't it currently causing tension within the SACO family that South Africa could become, people be, said that South Africa will become a North America for that matter, in this particular process, or is there a particular relationship that South Africa's objective is to empower to the ultimate the member state in SACO family?
Comrade Jenny, thank you. Comrade Kassman.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, I want to apologize for coming late. I did forward my apology to you this morning. Thank you, Chair. Chair, on slide 23, on the graph, I just want to get a clarity on our mandate as ICAC or perhaps as a country with regard to deciding on the increases or decreases in tariffs. Because I thought that what the presenter was saying, that perhaps the country is looking forward to a total reduction, you know, as against protection in some other areas which could take care of public interest, in particular the safeguarding of jobs in our industry. So is the mandate of the country geared towards total liberalization, or perhaps the mandate given to ITEC that they must actually, or is there a balance between these two? The last question is on slide 26, in relation to challenges, especially point two on the challenges. You referred to this one as, page 26. Thank you.
Thank you.
Page 26. You referred to common industrial development of common industrial policy. I think Comrade Zali did ask this question. But in particular, I'm interested to whether we as South Africa have an industrial policy in that we can start negotiation with these other countries so that we develop common industrial policy. Thank you.
Comrade Kasmeni, thank you very much. Comrade Sisa.
Thank you. Chair, in terms of the comment, you know, in certain areas, how it could have been nice if some of the presentation could have been for some sampling, or how some of these practices are done, because this work is quite technical. Although a little bit of reference was done to comparative analysis, a similar institution and practices. Maybe as we go along in the acting with the ITEC, that would be even far more helpful, because we definitely will be interacting with the very countries who handle the ITEC work in a different way, but that's down the line. So why and how are tariff amendments industry driven? Does ITEC get presentations, or does it call for presentations, or how is that area handled? The other area is that if one looks at the number of cases handled and the staff complement, unless my calculations or my comparison is way off the line, it seems there's a huge
load of work that ICAC does handle every year. To what extent does ICAC handle that? Do they outsource their work, or do they handle everything internally? And to what extent do they ensure that they are independent, so that they can take independence without necessarily being influenced, taken on board? I heard some things that there was mention or made that sometimes consultants mislead the industry. And so we would run a risk even within ITEC to be misled at times if some of the work is outsourced. We definitely are operating within a specific and a clearly defined, you know, socio-economic environment. I mean, climate work within Alvarez is still rampant. In the context of risk management, how would that be handled? Maybe I should be open about my loaded question. It's the capacity to access information, that's the independence to make sure that ITEC has got the right information to make correct decisions. The last one, much as we one admire the fact that you are helping SACU, we see the roadmap, but enter the SADC regional economic integration. How are we going to balance that traffic? Thank you.
Thank you, members. That's quite a basket of varied questions and comments. I'm sure it will entertain and stimulate our presenters intellectually. Over to you, good folks, for your enjoyment.
Thank you, Chairperson. We have noted all the questions, and we'll make sure that you answer all the questions and some that you might have omitted in the presentation. I've got a hold of it. To respond to the last question firstly, we are a government institution funded through Treasury, through the DGI. Therefore, we do not outsource. All of the work is done internally, although as acting chief executive, I can complain of resources because, one, I've got a dichotomy of staff. My staff is very old and very young. So there are people who are going on retirement. I've got two last year. I've got two this year. That is a challenge.
The question of old is relative, you see. You said you are as old as you feel.
Thank you, sir. So, from the work that we do, all of the work internally, our processes, and from the risk management point of view, we've got business processes that are managed by senior managers and the relevant general managers. Therefore, all of our work is internal. The work of the consultants that we referred to in trade remedies, the consultants assist the companies to put together an application. However, how they do that, we have a questionnaire or questionnaires that we do send out as to this is the information that is required. And before an application is final, there is constant communication between the applicant, which in this case would be represented by a consultant, and the unit concerned to ensure that, because you need to bring what is called information that is not deficient. Because if it is deficient, the commission might decide not to initiate. Therefore, there is constant interaction with stakeholders to ensure that the information that is brought. However, we do have a cut-off because we cannot go engaging for 12 months with people who need help and they don't give you the correct information all the time. So we do have instances where we say, we have done our best, we're putting it aside until you decide to give us the information that is required, we'll then continue with it. The other broad point I need to raise is, I think it is important that, unfortunately, I worked for NEDLEC when this body was established. I say unfortunate because there are huge problems with the Act. Maybe in the next few months, we'll bring through the Minister an amendment of the Act. There are huge governance problems with the Act. There are huge policy and procedure problems with the Act. So when ITEC was established, the intention of the legislature, of the legislators, would be assumed that ITEC would only be administrative, and the authority that ITEC would have would be constrained within that. Therefore, we do make recommendations. That is what the Act said, and that is what one would assume that the legislators intended ITEC to have those powers. Secondly, most of the decisions are political. I don't think that I'd be comfortable making some of the decisions. Therefore, I think that was the intention, to then make sure that if somebody who is an elected representative is in a position, you can make those recommendations. I'll then leave to my colleagues to answer the questions, but to also re-emphasize the point that we work within policies that are made by the DTI in government. The policy to liberalize trade was not ITEC. Government took a policy decision that we will liberalize trade. ITEC, you will administer. Government took a policy decision, we will move from import substitution to export promotion. ITEC, you've got the DCCS, please administer. What happened to the DCCS is another issue. And the role of SAGU in that process as well, that's another issue. But it's very difficult for me to can protect them, because it is crucially important. We do not have authority outside our mandate. We do not at all. All that we can do is what you are saying. SAGU. When we say we are assisting SAGU, capacity building, the Council of Ministers said, I can help the people, we are doing that. Development of common industrial policies, it is the DTR to lead. We give technical input. So it is, so the question on whether we do have an industrial policy or not, I'm not in a position you can answer, because I do not have the mandate to answer that. What I know is that there have been drafts that is done by the DTR. As to what say that is, I think the DG would be in a better position to can answer than I am. Common industrial policies, the process for that, how will that be possible? We give technical assistance. That's all. And that is why when Brenda talked about the process of SAGU, how it will affect us. Currently, we make recommendations to the minister. In future, when these structures are in place, we will make recommendations to the Council of Ministers. Imagine how that will affect our time frames and processes. So I think that I'll ask my colleagues to answer some of the questions.
Thank you very much, Madam.
Thank you, Chair. I'll speak to three questions. The first one is a question that was raised on if ITEC has this instrument of restricting imports, the import licenses, it should therefore be easy to use this instrument to protect domestic industries. Why are we not doing that on goods that are produced in SAGU? The first thing is that this area of import and export restrictions is an area that is governed by multilateral rules under the WTO. Now, in the case of import restrictions, the restrictions that we are able to put in place are with regards to second-hand goods. And the competition really that is faced by our domestic industries is with regards to new goods. Now, on new goods, you can only have these restrictions for the purposes of health, security, environmental reasons. It can't be for the purposes of protecting your domestic industry from fair competition, from competing with exports. And again, these are rules that we are part of, and they also take care of our interests, because other countries could do the same to us on our exports. And if you violate these rules, other countries can retaliate. They can take you to WTO for dispute settlement. On the question of the movement away from protection, what the presenter was trying to say is that, yes, from 94, the overall policy direction has been to reduce duties. This has been done gradually and in a strategic manner, depending on the competitiveness levels of various sectors. So what you find in our tariff regime is that it's differentiated. You do have a number of lines that are at zero. Some lines have moderate duties, 5 to 10, but the most sensitive products would have the highest duties. So it has never been a blanket approach. It's differentiated. This has happened as a result of our commitments to the WTO, our SADC agreement, our EU agreement. But in terms of the current industrial policy discussions that are taking place at the DTI, in terms of the formulation of the national industrial policy, what we have now is a much more nuanced approach on trade policy, where in terms of the ITEC instruments, what is being said is that on primary products, raw materials that are going to be used for downstream manufacturing, the direction should be to reduce duties so as to lower the cost of production downstream, add more value, create jobs, and attract investments. However, downstream, it is said that the duties that are in place currently should be maintained. However, this will be done on a case-by-case basis. There is more emphasis now on linking tariff amendments to the sector strategy, such that tariff amendments are informed by sector strategies. There was a talk of further simplifying the tariff structure, but what is being said now is that in simplifying the tariff structure, let us link that or integrate that to what we are doing now under the Doha Round, and therefore not unilaterally simplify the tariff structure and reduce duties, but do so within the context of the Doha Round, which, if it is successful, will lead to further reduction of duties, will lead to ITEC not being able to have the same space it has now in terms of reducing duties, because the boundaries are going to go down to the level of the applied rate. The question that has been raised on SAGU, I know we keep on saying that some of the questions that are being asked are trade and industrial policy questions that are not in our mandate. The custodians are the relevant DTI divisions. But because there is an interface between our work and these broader trade and industrial policy issues, we will try and speak on some of these issues. It is true that in SAGU what you find is there's a huge imbalance. 95% of the economic activity or GDP of SAGU, you could say, is in South Africa. The remaining members share the 5%. They are dependent on their imports. 90% of their imports come from South Africa. So there is this huge disparity. How does this play out in terms of the SAGU arrangement? I think South Africa has been on the forefront of democratizing SAGU, which then helps to bring in a balance, bring in more transparency and fairness in terms of decision making. But for ITEC, one of the concerns that we have in terms of the democratization of SAGU is that the work that we will be doing will now go to the SAGU Tariff Board and then the Council of Ministers. Now, in terms of our regulations, we work within time frames. Even in terms of the anti-dumping, the time frames are set in the WTO agreement. Our concern is, are we going to be responsive as we are currently to industry needs, as when the sample institutions are operational? We've tried to take that into account in the development of the rules of procedure for these institutions. Maybe just to take another question, the last one. Why are tariff amendments industry driven? Why is ITEC a reactive institution? By and large, it is. However, there are cases where ITEC becomes proactive. There are investigations that have been self-initiated out of an assessment done by ITEC of a particular industry. The steel investigation, for example, which led to the reduction of all steel primary products from 5% to zero. We are now looking at proactively initiating an investigation on machinery and capital equipment. This we are doing in light of the huge infrastructure projects that government will be engaged in. We're talking about 400 billion over 3 to 5 years. For all these projects, almost 50% would be imports. And the question that we are looking at as ITEC is, on this 50% of imports for these huge projects, what are the duty implications? So there is, to a certain extent, some proactiveness on our part. Yes, this kind of work requires very skilled people. We have a staff of around 120. These have got to be people who are skilled in accounting and economics. The information that we get from industry is information that gets verified by our investigators. There is desk verification, there is on-site verification in the factory. And so the accuracy of the information is one of the most important things in the work of ITEC. Ultimately, the decisions are based on the numbers. These have to be accurate. Thanks.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir. Just to respond on the question with regard to the importation of new clothing by charitable organizations, I can just say that this has been a contentious issue for many years. There was a period during which the importation of used clothing by charitable organizations was allowed. However, the abuse of the system resulted in the rebate item that was there, which is rebate item 405 in terms of Schedule 4 of the Customs and Excise Act, be amended to exclude second-hand clothing in particular. So, I don't think at the moment we entertain as many applications as we did in the past, because I think the general knowledge out there is that it is not provided for, because there is no provision in the Customs and Excise Act to be able to import used clothing as a charitable organization in terms of this specific rebate provision. But however, should it be opened up again, be allowed again, I can only assume that the influx of used clothing will once again, especially now with China and other players and other forces in the market, this will really get to a stage where it will be out of control. It is allowed in instances where there is a natural disaster, like you've alluded to, then the regions can obtain permission to import second-hand clothing under rebate of duty and also be provided with an import permit to do so. We know that used clothing that came in illegally are being seized by South African Revenue Service. We know that there is auction of these goods. Usually it is for export purposes or it is for recycling purposes under customs supervision. Then if we get to the question with regard to Western scrap. The flow of Western scrap is controlled in terms of the Basel Convention. The Basel Convention's aim is to regulate the transboundary movement of Western scrap. So there is cooperation and coordination between ourselves, as I indicated earlier, and the Department of Environmental Affairs. Should it be a waste or a scrap material, that is not restricted in terms of the Basel Convention. And if it is for recycling or manufacturing purposes, then it can be allowed. You think, for instance, in the case of waste paper and paperboard, which is usually in short supply in South Africa, those are being allowed to be imported for recycling purposes. However, should somebody would like to import scrap lead, which is an environmental hazardous substance or product, the answer is usually no. Should the Department of Environmental Affairs be satisfied that the scrap lead will be recycled by accredited recyclers, and in terms of the program run by ECFID, then such import permits will be issued on the recommendation of Environmental Affairs. Then with regard to agricultural products, agricultural products are excluded from import control measures. I think the last program or process of removing import control measures on agricultural products took place in 1995 in terms of South Africa's obligations in terms of the WTO. Thank you, Chair. I think I've taken care of that one.
Thank you, Mr. Sneeman. It's very good. Good folks. We've had a good engagement. And Tate Make ask before I wrap up, because this is not going to be the last session that we have with ITEC.
Thank you, Comrade. Just for interest sake, I was just thinking about countries that are landlocked, Zimbabwe and Switzerland, in terms of the health and environment. I'm under the impression that the goods arrive in Cape Town and I've got to cross through South Africa to Botswana or something. Do you have anything to do with that? Thank you.
Mr. Huffman.
Yeah, just one question, Chair. The involvement of ITEC in the MIGP, we must congratulate them and the players there because there are jobs that are created. However, we're concerned about the pricing, and they involved with the pricing, particularly to the local, you know, domestic market, the domestic consumers, whilst these cars are exported, they're cheaper abroad. Thank you. What is it that they're doing about that?
You may have rejoined it to that.
I'll take the MIGP one and Philip will take the other question. Thank you for commending us for the role that we are playing in the administration of the MIGP. Amongst the objectives of the program, what the program has been able to achieve is to increase imports, investments, maintain employment. But what we have not been able to achieve in terms of this program is affordable prices. Now that the MIDP is under review, this remains one of the questions that has to be answered in the review of the book. ITEC really has nothing to do with this question and possibility of motor vehicles.
Thank you. Mr. Schneeman, you can hear
We control certain goods destined for home consumption. So, if goods arrive at port in South Africa, destined for our neighbors, Swaziland, Lesotho, Botswana, wherever, those goods are usually cleared, removal in bonds or removal in transit. These are terms used by South African Revenue Service. Means there's a particular formality attached to this, and we have no say or no control over this. However, it is goods that's controlled in terms of our regulations, and those goods enter Lesotho, for instance, and those goods want to come back to South Africa. Those goods are once again subject to import control measures administered by ICAC. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Members and all the representatives from ITEC, what I'd like to say is that because of the nature of the issues that we have been discussing today, it cannot be correct that we should have a once per year engagement with you. I'd like also say that unfortunately today in particular, we did not have the full complement of the members of this portfolio committee. Those who were available obviously benefited from our engagement, have got a clearer insight on a number of aspects. And even if everyone was present here, that's a member of this portfolio committee, we would still not have done justice from both sides in terms of the questions that can be posed in terms of the level of engagement. And there are also institutional challenges that you have. The nature of ITEC, its relationship with the department, the functionality of being tasked with carrying out certain responsibility, obviously the department having full responsibility for policy formulation, and then the grey aspects that result from this engagement. So of needs be, we will interact with the material, your annual reports and other reports, and then look at our program. I'll remind our committee clerk next year that we should look at where we can slot you in our program. You made mention of the Doha development round, and obviously there are moves afoot now where the main players realized that this was supposed to be a development round in the interest of the developing world. And thus far, people are doing their best to re-stimulate the round and look for this outcome, the basis on which this round was initiated. So all these issues, they also relate to your work. So we need to come back and engage in regard to a number of these issues. And then perhaps to end where we started, we also spoke about the nature and the responsibility that members of parliament have. They have to ask the difficult questions in the manner in which they ask them, not because they want to be difficult with you, but it's their responsibility to their respective constituencies. Somebody might be passionate about the peasantry. Somebody else will be passionate about the township dwellers. Somebody else will be passionate about the people who stay in informal settlements. This is what brings us to Parliament, that mandate of the people. But what links us with you as a unit operating within the ambit of
the DTI is that we've got a common responsibility to the economic citizens of this country and the people of this country. That's where the symbiotic relationship kicks in. You have to carry out your task to the best of your ability, and likewise, we have to do the same. And within the confines of this common compact, this is where the citizens of this country will derive benefit. So in order to be true to that mandate, our engagement has to be frank, open, constructively critical. So this is the manner and the foundation on which we execute our work. So I'm merely trying to say that we will call you back and then look more critically at some aspects. We have not asked or made comments on all the areas that we could or that we should. So I'm merely saying that this will be an ongoing engagement, hopefully to the mutual benefit of all involved. Members, I'd like to thank you. But before we do with the business of the day, I still have a full meeting here. The members of the opposition have been here, but they had to dash to some other engagements. They do not have the luxury of the ANC, that there's many more members. So they've got to spread themselves between many other meetings that are taking place concurrently. Thus, most of the members of the opposition have had to leave. The only thing that we still need to do is we have had the report on China. So all I need is somebody to propose and somebody to second. Then this report can be tabled where else it needs to be tabled. The opposition members have read the report. It has been distributed to you several times. So that's the trip comrades went to China last year.
Thank you, Chairperson. I propose that the report should be adopted as it is. Comrade Cutman.
Thank you, Chair. I also second the adoption of this report.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank the delegation from ITEC, and we appreciate the full nature of your delegation and all the specialists in the various areas. So it does help when people come and make a presentation and you are able to have the benefit of the input of all the relevant role players, so that it does not just become the responsibility of one person to give an overarching presentation. So I'd just like to say that on behalf of the committee, we thank you for your input and we'll continue engaging you. Thank you very much.